The topic I want to introduce today is the connection between states and Lagrangians of manifolds. So if we recall in the story of geometric quantization, I take some symplectic manifold and I take some map M to some base manifold where the dimension of B n, and that's half of the dimension of M. And further, you want functions on B Poisson commute. So we had this ansatz that the Hilbert space of the quantum mechanical system is given by functions on the Bohr-Sommerfeld points of B. Hilbert space H, and this is going to be C-valued function. Bohr-Sommerfeld points. So in particular, if I take some point and B is a Bohr-Sommerfeld point, then the delta function at B is a state in the Hilbert space. So what we'd like to understand today is, well, this gives us a kind of geometric understanding of these particular states. You know, these guys, as B varies, these will form a basis. So we get a nice understanding of that basis. So is there some geometric object which is going to correspond to some linear combination of these states? And we'll find that the geometric object is a submanifold of M of middle dimension, satisfying a condition called being Lagrangian. Let's explain that. So to understand what's going on, we should think that this state is associated to the submanifold inside of M, which at least generically is of dimension n. And then we want to generalize this by thinking about other kinds of submanifold that might be associated to this. Definition a submanifold L inside of M is Lagrangian if, one, it's half dimensional, and two, the symplectic form restricted to L is zero. So there's a couple of equivalent characterizations. If locally L is cut out by the equations f1, fn equals 0, because it's half dimensional, so I need to impose n equations to get the manifold of dimension of middle dimension. Then condition 2 is equivalent to you saying that the Poisson brackets in these f's are equal to 0 on L.
Sorry, can I back up a second?
Yeah, absolutely.
That would be a state here.
Well, we decided that the Hilbert space was spanned by functions in the Bohr-Sommer points, and this is a particular function, that the delta function at that point.
So we're choosing, this is a choice of a function?
Yes.
Where does this choice come from? Is it just, I guess, like we want it to peak at B?
It's the natural basis, right? So in ordinary quantum mechanics, our states are functions of position, like functions of x. And the delta functions are one natural basis for that Hilbert space. So any state can be expanded as a sum of delta functions. So we're doing something analogous here. This is one natural basis for the Hilbert space.
For usual delta function, you think of it mapping the point zero to like real infinity. But in this case, if we're mapping to the complex plane, how does a delta function work?
Okay, so that you shouldn't. I mean, that's not a great. I mean, it's okay, but it's not the very best heuristic. So what a delta function isn't really a function. A delta function is something you can integrate against. So it's really a measure. A measure means something you can integrate against a function, and is characterized by the integral of the delta function against anything, x equals 0, is the value. So this expression makes sense if f is a complex valued function too.
One question: what did it mean to be cut out by?
It's the subset where all of these functions vanish.
Sorry, didn't hear that. Well,
it's the subset where these n functions are all zero.
Okay.
So n equations, and these are the.
Okay. Okay.
So let's give some examples about what this condition means. So, for example. If I have coordinates q1, q2, q1, q2, and omega is qi wedge bi, you might try to take L to be the locus, or q1 is 0, and q1 is 0. So this is bad. This is not a Lagrangian submanifold, as the Poisson bracket E1 is equal to 1 is not 0 in L. Or E2 are coordinates in L, and the symplectic form looks restricted to L is dq2 wedge dp2, which is also not zero. So roughly speaking, the intuition you should have, this turns out to be a very good intuition, is that if we have a Lagrangian, we want to set a bunch of coordinates to zero. We never want to set any canonically conjugate pair to zero. That's not going to make sense. And, well, you should know that that's never going to make sense, because if I set a canonically conjugate pair to zero, I'd be simultaneously measuring position and momentum, and I can't do that.
What is the difference between Lagrangian and polarization?
Lagrangian and which, say?
Polarization.
A polarization is for each b in the base, this submanifold will be Lagrangian. So a polarization is a family of Lagrangians, one passing through every point. If I have a polarization, then the inverse image of B is a Lagrangian or at least generic B. I mean, sometimes it might collapse something smaller dimensional, so let's worry about that. So if I have a polarization, and then you have the following picture, you have a large number of Lagrangians like this, cutting up your manifold into these slices. Whereas here, we're just talking about a single Lagrangian. To understand the really concrete way of what it means to have a Lagrangian, there's the following theorem called the Darboux-Weinstein theorem. If L is a coordinate, say is a Lagrangian, then there exists coordinates locally pi qi, so that omega is some dqi wedge dpi, and L is the locus, or pi is zero. So the intuition we have is Lagrangian, we set half the variables to zero, but they have to be a collection of variables which commute with each other. And this theorem tells us that that intuition is a good one. Like, no matter how kind of curved our Lagrangian is, locally we can always change coordinates so it looks like this simple situation. Okay, any questions?
I have a question about the commutation there, because you already set p and q to zero, so they're both zero operators. Why do they still not commute?
I mean, it's just some algebra, right? I mean, they're I'm just noticing that the Poisson bracket of P and Q is 1. So
yeah, I was just confused, because Yeah, I see that in general that should be true, but here you're already setting them to zero, so it seems like they're have some privilege advantage as well.
What's happening is you can look at the we're not setting them to zero absolutely. We're saying the Lagrangian is the locus where it vanishes. And there's no guarantee that if some function vanishes on the Lagrangian, that its Poisson brackets also will, because the Poisson brackets involve derivatives.
So this derivative is not derivative like within the...
Exactly. It's normal. If this is a derivative, so here the Lagrangian q1, q1 is 0. So the Poisson bracket with q1 is d by dq1, and that's normal to the Lagrangian. That's why, but you raise a very good point. So I wanted to explain. You can ask, why is this a good condition to be a state in the quantum system? And as you will see in a moment, or any this Poisson bracket becomes a commutator. There's some algebraic reason, kind of like what you just said, which forces this to be true in a quantum system. So, how would we go from quantum state and then we can take a h bar to zero limit? That's going to become a Lagrangian. So how does this work? If psi is a state, and we let A be the deformation quantization, the algebra functions on M. So I'm changing the product in such a way that the leading order, the commutator, is the Poisson bracket. And we can look at a subset of operators O so that O psi is equal to 0. So the subset of operators which annihilate this state. And the idea is when we take the classical limit, this is going to be a subset of functions which vanish on some submanifold. So I hope it's clear, for people who've studied algebraic geometry, which I think very few people have, this is, how people think about submanifolds in geometry. But in general, any submanifold is determined by the collection of those functions which vanish on it. Because the functions which vanish on it, those are just the equations, the defining equations of that submanifold. So now we can ask ourselves, this slightly abstract procedure, why, if I do this, why do I end up with something satisfying these equations? And the intuition is Well, it's really the uncertainty principle. I have a state, it can have definite momentum, and then its position is undetermined. So for example, if momentum was included in here, or momentum minus some number, then position couldn't be. So whatever state we have, when I take this classical limit, I'm only going to set half the variables to zero, and they can never be canonically conjugate pair. Because if I had a canonically conjugate pair, I'd be violating the uncertainty. But more algebraically, if O1, O2 are in my subset, this is called an ideal in algebra, then so is the commutator. Now, since we know that the commutator becomes the Poisson bracket when I take the limit as h bar goes to zero, and this means these Poisson bracket is also in this subset, okay, so we've derived this condition just from the algebra about how deformation quantization works. So one might ask, you know, why does L have to be of middle dimension? Couldn't it be bigger? Couldn't I impose fewer equations? And the answer is, this condition that L is of middle dimension will arise when I have a pure state in my quantum system. If I have a mixed state, it'd be bigger. I mean, having a pure state means you're imposing as many equations as you can possibly do on your state, which means half of them. OK, so let's do some examples of our questions.
OK. I'm not fully grasping something about the limit. So for instance, here, I'm thinking that O of psi. I'm interpreting that as saying if psi, for instance, is a state of, n, m, and l, you know, energy n, angular momentum l, and the z component m, so O would be something like the lz minus l acting on that equals zero.
Exactly.
These are the three, and well, yeah. There are equations like that, and they generate an algebra.
Yes, and then you literally take those equations, and then you. And h bar to zero, and you get a submanifold.
The equations lz minus m.
Those are the equations. You just treat them classically.
I take that h bar go to zero. Okay.
Yeah.
You said that l, like in certain cases, can be larger dimensions than half of m.
Yes.
I guess it would still be restricted to be even dimensional because we
no.
Have some logic structure, or.
I mean, that this. If you look at this constraint without this constraint of the dimension, it's called being coisotropic. No, it doesn't have to be even dimension. It can be of any dimension between half the dimension and the whole dimension.
But in, like there's no case, I guess. Like it obviously has to be integer dimension.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's okay. Yeah.
there you said that if you set P1 and Q1 both to 0, that does not guarantee that their Poisson product is 0.
Mm-hmm.
In the Darboux theorem, setting all the P is equal to 0 guarantees that.
Yes, because the Poisson bracket among the P's, between any two P's, is 0.
But it's only locally that all the P's are 0, right?
Yes.
So we can't say anything
No, you can. By locally, I don't mean on the Lagrangian. I mean in a small neighborhood of the Lagrangian. So it includes the Taylor expansion normal to the Lagrangian.
So, could it? Maybe just to belabor that point, I think, for instance, here it says Poisson bracket between P1 and Q1 is equal to 0. Which is equal to 1, which is not 0 on L.
Yes.
And maybe that claim, maybe it's true. Would it be better to say that it's 0 on, it's not 0 on M? Like we're using the Poisson bracket that exists on M.
Let's do an example. So let's say your coordinate is P1, P2. Q1, Q2. And you might take your equations to be P1 equals 0, P2 equals 0, and then that's fine as these guys 0. But I might take my equations to be P1, 1 plus Q1 squared equals 0, P2, 1 plus Q2 squared, 1 squared, whatever. Now, these are the same equations. Because 1 plus q1 squared is never 0. So it's only this. But now it's the same submanifold. It's the same submanifold, but I've chosen to view it as a solution of slightly different equations. And now here, if I take the Poisson bracket between these two of them, f2, you find f1, f2, there's going to be a term involving that. Something like 2q1p2. But that's not 0, but it is equal to 0 on L, because it's divisible by p2.
So ultimately, it must be restrained to L in the end, in the final analysis.
Exactly, just because there's a freedom to like multiply your defining equations by something which doesn't vanish.
Usually when we talk about the Lagrangian, it's a function, right? Or like a
It's terrible terminology. It's just, you know, whatever his name was, Lagrange invented both things. There's no relationship between them whatsoever.
It's not like one lives on the other.
Nope. No. They're just both named after the same person. They should have chosen a different name because there's Lagrangian mechanics, but then Lagrangians play an important role in Hamiltonian mechanics, and it's like, really. So I hope this will be clarified with some simple examples. So this is the p-axis, this is the q-axis. I'm going to just take omega b dq dp. Now say, what's the Lagrangian or q equal to 0 corresponds to what state? Well, let me draw it. I don't know if that's distinguishable from the vertical axis, but when we quantize, p hat becomes 1 over 2 pi I e by dq. and q hat is equal to q. This is when we view the Hilbert space as functions of q. So if I want a function, we want some set my state to be a function of q to be such that q times psi q equals 0. So that is, we're taking this equation, defining the submanifold, and lifting it to an equation about how this operator acts on this state. Now, I think it should be clear what it is. The solution is psi q is delta function at q equals 0. So here we notice that it has definite position. But undetermined momentum. And what's nice is we can just see it from the picture. I'm drawing a submanifold. The submanifold lives at a particular position, so it has definite position. But its momentum just goes everywhere, so its momentum is undetermined. OK, similarly, if we took p equals 0, it would give me the state psi equals 1. So p equals 0 is this axis here. And this state has definite momentum. And one more example. Here the Lagrangian is p equals q. So what's this going to become? We just play the same game. We just look in the quantum system and impose this equation for the quantized operator. So e hat 1 over 2 pi I LQ. So we want 1 over 2 pi I LQ equals Q and minus Q of psi Q equals 0. So what we found is that this like ordinary algebraic equation has simply become a differential equation, or I've replaced P by Q by dQ. Now we solve this equation. Psi is p to the 1 up to some factors of pi. It looks like e to the q squared.
Yep.
So in this case, for choosing p equals to 0 and using the state psi equals 1, like from this like the, this process, I would think that psi could be any constant.
Yes, absolutely. So there's an ambiguity of an overall scalar.
Yeah, like the global phase, I guess you could say, like
exactly
quantum states, like in general.
Exactly. That global phase is unphysical.
Yes. Yeah. And then okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, I have a question. Do we interpret psi as some kind of probabilistic information?
Is it some kind of probabilistic information?
What would you mean by this picture?
Oh, by that I meant in the sense of quantum mechanics, it's an eigenstate for momentum, but it is not an eigenstate for position. Right here, you know, psi equals one, it's an eigenstate for momentum, but if I was to write it in terms of position eigenstates are the delta functions, it would be an infinite sum, each weighted by one. So So the probability, you can think that the probability amplitude it's at a particular position is kind of uniformly distributed.
Okay. In the second example, is the Poisson bracket zero on the Lagrangian manifold?
Yes. In fact, when you only have one p and one q, the Lagrangian condition becomes trivial because it just has to be middle dimensional, because then it's cut out by one function, and one function can't have an interesting Poisson bracket with itself.
How are we defining the action of Q on the delta function? Because it seems different from the action on other regular functions.
Yeah. So we call the delta function Q equals zero, FQ equals F zero. This is the defining feature of it. Now, I suppose I multiply the delta function by something else, G of Q. And then figure out, well, this should be some multiple of the delta function. Figure out which one it is. Let's measure its integral against f. Now clearly, this is g of zero, f of zero, because this integral just picks out the value at zero. So this tells us that g of q, delta function q equals zero, is equal to g of zero. So taking g to be q in particular, we get zero.
One question. What was I thinking? So yeah, it seems when the line was completely vertical, we had fixed position, and so our set was delta of q. I suppose, well, clearly when it's horizontal, it should be a delta of p. It should be
absolutely, which it is, right? Because it's
Okay.
One is the Fourier transform, the delta function.
Yeah, somehow the line like this is interpolating between the two in some way.
I mean, there's some annoying factor of I here, but basically a Gaussian.
Yeah. And maybe one question is, does every state have an associated Lagrangian manifold, or?
Yes. Yeah, you can definitely, I mean, you can definitely take a state and like study its classical limit, and that will give you an equation defining Lagrangians. Okay, maybe sometimes that might be a very singular equation and not a submanifold because it's too singular, but whatever, generally.
If I have a state, how would I construct the equation, sorry? The P equals Q equation?
Well, your state is a function of Q. It's a function of Q which will satisfy some differential equation. And you take the classical limit of that differential equation.
Yeah, and can I always, I would have to always reverse engineer a differential equation in terms of the p's and derivatives with, yeah, and derivatives such that the state zero. I would reverse engineer that.
Yeah, it's okay. You're right. Suppose I took some kind of crazy state which was kind of going all over the place. It would be hard to figure out, and maybe it wouldn't be an honest differential equation because, you know, when I look in this submanifold, I'm allowed to have like e to the p, cos p, all that kind of stuff. So that kind of thing might appear in your differential equation. It would be a pseudo-differential equation. Any reasonable state, you'll get a differential equation, and it's a bit more complicated in general.
Okay. And maybe one last question. That interpolation between the pure P and the pure Q, is there a way to associate the fact, I don't know, the steepness or something with the fact that we got a Gaussian, which is a very specific superposition of the Qs. Is there any way to give some interpretation to that?
Yeah, I was going to explain that next. There's a kind of formula to go from the Lagrangian to the state. Which? I think this formula is going to be valid in some regime of series in H bar or something like this. Just some detail I'm not getting totally right in my head, but so let's ask the question. So given a Lagrangian inside of R2, what is psi of Q? L to make sure it depends on L. And here's answer. So let's assume for simplicity, this can be removed. That L intersect the locus or Q is a constant is always a point. So I wanted like a graph of a function like that. I don't want to have something which curves back. I don't want to have any vertical lines, just for simplicity. L is the graph of a function G on or in, obviously, the graph of a function, and the state is psi Q, which satisfies so L looks like, you know, E equals G. So now, figure out the state, we just replace this by a differential equation. So we solve this differential equation by integrating. There's another way of figuring out what this is, which is a nice expression that works in general. we, as usual, we take alpha, in our case, be 2 pi I qdp. So the syntactic form is d alpha over 2 pi I. And then we can compute our picture. Psi q1 minus psi q0 is equal to I think this is multiplicative. Exponential of the integral alpha. Or the integral is along this path. C naught, C one, and L. So the nice thing about this formula is it's really pretty general. Maybe I won't write it out, but it should apply any time you have a polarization. How do I figure out what my what function on the base corresponds to my Lagrangian? I integrate. I take the Wilson line along a path connecting two intersection points. So let's quickly check that for a straight line, we get the right answer. L is the locus. E equals Q, then I can take it like this. C naught is 0, C1 is EQ, alpha is 1 over 2 pi I, UDP. So on L, DP is EQ. So that alpha is 2 pi I over 2 EQ squared. So that the integral from 0 Q of alpha is 2 pi I over 2 Q squared. And then when we exponentiate, we got what we have. Okay, so this is just some kind of fun geometric intuition for how to figure out the state corresponding to a Lagrangian. Now, one more thing which I forgot to mention. For a Lagrangian, this will really correspond to a state. Only if the Bohr-Sommerfeld condition is satisfied. If omega is 1 over 2 pi I field strength of some U1 gauge field, And exactly as we had before, we want e to the integral a 1 for all loops in L.
Can we go back to this one second?
Yes.
Why is alpha, why did it have a dq squared? What does that mean? Like, that's not dq wedge, like, it's a one form, right? So
it's d of q squared. I'm just saying that q dq is dq squared.
Oh, d of q squared in parentheses.
Sorry.
Okay. And
sorry, that wasn't clear.
Below, you wrote it.
And well, I'm integrating it, but because it's a total derivative, I just pick up the boundary term.
The Wilson line itself is the wave function. It's used to define the notion of parallel transportation in some sense.
Yes.
The wave function is doing the parallel transportation of states. Is that?
There's something I feel I don't really understand, which is, when we write the Lagrangian corresponding to a symplectic manifold, this is one of the terms, integral of alpha along a path. And it's also one of the terms in the Bohr-Sommerfeld condition. I'm a little bit confused as to why. So I feel like the question is about that.
What are the conditions on the Lagrangian submanifold having to be symplectic? Well, okay, especially here, I'm thinking our two form from alpha to zero, right? If dp equals dq.
Yeah, absolutely. So the condition to be Lagrangian was that when I take the two form on L is zero.
So from the beginning, we're kind of leaving our symplectic manifold.
Exactly.
Considering so.
I mean, it's part of this.
Anymore in this new space.
Well, we could do. Well, yeah, that was the next thing. Because we can ask, you know, if I have a Hamiltonian, there's a Hamiltonian vector field on the symplectic manifold. The Lagrangian is a submanifold. It could be moved around by that to a new Lagrangian.
The original space that I have.
Yeah. So. So, for example, Hamiltonian could be p squared. The vector field Hamiltonian would then be p del q. Let's draw a picture of this vector field. It's like this. Moves you in the q direction. At a speed proportional to how high you are in the p direction. Now, L might be flowed by this. Took my Lagrangian to be something like this. When I hit it with PDQ, I'm going to rotate. If L is a locus, P equals Q, And when we flow, well, Poisson bracket of H, P minus Q, is minus P. So L becomes the set 1 plus epsilon P minus Q. When we flow by T. Okay, so you can kind of see this in the picture. Lagrangian is being moved geometrically because the vector field given by the Hamiltonian does not point along the Lagrangian. It's normal to it. So it changes its position. Okay, so what's the point of this? So we want to ask, when is a state an eigenstate? The classical limit of an eigenstate. Is L the classical limit the answer is the following. Lemma. This happens if and only if the vector field XH points along L. So this seems a reasonable thing, right? We want to be an eigenstate. It doesn't evolve in time, except for we multiply it by some constant, which doesn't matter. And here we're saying the Lagrangian is an eigenstate if and only if it doesn't flow. The flow is parallel to L, but L does not move. Oh, I'm my poor use of the blackboard here, sorry. So proof is local coordinates pi py so that L is the set where pi is equal to 0. Then xh is some dh dpi d by dqi minus dh dqi by dpi. So we look at these two terms. The second term L is the locus where P is 0. So the derivative with respect to P points up. And the derivative with respect to Q points along L. So this term here points normal to L. And this term here points along L. So in order for this vector field to point along L, we want this second term to vanish. and only if. On L. And since Q's are coordinates on L, this means H is constant on L. Which is the semi-classical version of L being an eigenstate. Is this last sentence, do I need to say more about this last sentence? Why this H being constant in L is the semi-classical version of being an eigenstate? Yeah, okay. Well, so to see that, you need to think like, let's take the quantum Hamiltonian. So H hat psi is equal to some constant times psi. This is the state, and this is the Hamiltonian. That's what it means to be an eigenstate. So H hat minus C psi L is equal to 0. So that in the classical limit, recall we said those functions which vanish on L are the classical limit of those operators which annihilate this state. So in the classical limit, H minus C vanishes on L, so that H is equal to C on L. Okay, so what have we learned? That an eigenstate is a submanifold where the Hamiltonian points along, the Lagrangian where the Hamiltonian points along, meaning it doesn't evolve in time. Any questions? Yeah.
This construction works for any like observable and any associated Hamiltonian vector field, right? Because you can just say it for eigenstate of any particular observable you want to measure, like or
exactly. Yeah.
Jesus Christ! Yeah.
Have I blown your mind?
Yeah, I barely recovered from that one. Now this one. But I mean,
it's like Woodstock. I don't know.
I mean, because here we were saying what? That, I mean, I had seen parallel transport, yeah, if you move an electron adiabatically or something, but now the structure that undergirds quantum mechanics itself in a way or something, it's the kinematics is also has the same patterns as
yeah.
The dynamics. So the wave function can be determined as a parallel transport of the presymplectic along the Lagrangian. And you mentioned already that you feel there's some mystery there. Is there any other remarks that can be made about that?
I think if you're really interested in this, you should go visit a paper of Witten called "The Path Integral of Quantum Mechanics Revisited."
Yeah, I
think I mentioned that before.
I have to revisit. Yeah, I have to check that one. And then here we're saying. So states, are these curves that we can evolve them in the Hamiltonians, or be those curves that are invariant in your Hamiltonian flow?
Mm-hmm.
Because they satisfy that, in the Hilbert space, they satisfy the eigenvalue equation.
Yes.
In the classical limit, they are locuses of constant H, therefore, yeah.
Yeah.
Through Nether's theorem or something, whatever, H is the momentum map, whatever.
No, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, okay.
Yeah. No, I mean in the case where there's two dimensions, Lagrangians are just one-dimensional things, and they're the eigenstates are exactly the flows of H. in higher dimensions because you know, there it's the flows of H only point in one direction. There's still a lot of freedom to build Lagrangians, which are preserved by it.
Sorry, I didn't understand that last claim. What gives us a lot of freedom to build in what circumstance?
So, say in four dimensions, where I have two P's and two Q's, the flows of H are like are lines in your four-dimensional space. But your Lagrangian is a two-dimensional submanifold, and your condition is it has to be a union of such lines. But there's many ways to do that.
So, like, I guess seeing as like this kind of classical formalism of quantum mechanics in terms of Lagrangians and manifolds and you know, stuff like that, it seems like there's good ways to move between that formalism and the actual quantum mechanical like Hilbert space. So, what, I guess like what advantage or is there an advantage between looking at the Hilbert space picture versus this picture, and like why people tend to talk about quantum mechanics in this Hilbert space formalism rather than like these submanifolds and stuff like that? Like, what what's the advantage to kind of both pictures?
Well, I mean. So the advantage of this picture is it's much more geometrical.
Yeah.
And it's also, when you're dealing with a complicated complicated Lagrangian, I wouldn't know any other way to really figure out what the Hilbert space should be. So the disadvantage of this is, so you might have been, you know, we were able to say compute the spectrum of the harmonic oscillator using this geometrical method. If you were to work in a much more complicated system, which wasn't integrable, then higher order quantum corrections would play a very important role, and those wouldn't be easily seen with the geometry. So the geometry, not quite as useful for some like very, you take some random Hamiltonian.
One basic question I'm not able to understand is, what's the role of the classical limit here? Because h cap minus c is 0 on L. So what does h bar tending to 0 have to do?
Well, when I talk about geometry, we really have to have commuting functions. Mm-hmm. So because you know, functions on a manifold commute. So I think anything geometric, we always have to take h bar. Zero or close to zero.
So suppose we take this example where the Lagrangian submanifold is p is equal to q.
Mm-hmm.
Then the wave function turns out to be that exponential. But if we did consider h bar, p should have been h bar upon 2 pi something.
Yes.
Then if we took the limit h bar goes to zero, this wave function would just be some constant.
We would have like a q squared over h bar in it.
Yeah.
Let's see. I would say the way to think about it is take that wave function and look at the differential equation it satisfies, and then put a h bar in the differential equation, take the classical limit, get an algebraic equation. That algebraic equation is for the straight line.
Question. I'm thinking, in some sense, there are two steps. Like, so we say, so if we do deformation quantization, our observables are these functions on phase space, and
mm-hmm.
they have the Moyle product that will be this H bar expansion between, and
mm-hmm.
so I suppose, but then there's, when you say that the operator acting psi, where you're really choosing some sort of representation. So what I would say is, if you have the eigen, well, that's how I distinguish it too, but if you have the eigenstate equation, for instance, map it now, you have an operator, map it back to the observables with a Moyle product, they generate an algebra, all the constraints equations you do, they will generate an algebra with the Moyle product, and that will have an h-bar expansion when you do the products of all of those. And that h-bar expansion is the one you set to zero, and that will generate equations that are actually that generate surfaces under your manifold. That's what I was thinking about.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely. This is looking good.
And does this Lagrangian surface uniquely specify a quantum state, or maybe there's multiple states that have the same classical?
There's multiple states that have the same classical limit, because if I take a complicated differential equation, like say I take P Q squared plus something like that, when I want to quantize it, you get P hat Q hat. This has many different ways to quantize it depending on the orderings, because I could have like P hat squared Q hat squared, E hat, Q hat, E hat, Q hat. These are different. So when I take an equation like this and try to quantize it, there's always an ordering ambiguity. So if you were very careful about it, there's some kind of scaling limit where the classical system picks out some like leading term in the quantum. The term with most derivatives independent. So again, because we've kind of considered example where this ordering ambiguity isn't very important, you might be misled, but it is important for more complicated examples.
I feel like I see more or less what's happening in the one particle picture. Is there something interesting and geometrical to be said about how entanglement?
I was about to say that.
Oh,
yeah.
Great. Just go.
Suppose we have a product of two systems. So for example, M1 is OR2, the coordinates P1, Q1, M2 also is OR2, coordinates P2, Q2, and a Lagrangian L that M1 times M2 is separable if L is L1 times L2. Otherwise, it's entangled. Let me do an example to see why, if I take a Lagrangian which is not separable and I turn it into a quantum state, then that quantum state is entangled. Okay, so I'll take this example where each M is OR2, the coordinates P1, P2, Q2, P2, Q2. Take L be the set where Q1 is equal to Q2 and P1 is equal to minus P2. So since the Poisson bracket of P1 plus P2, Q1 minus Q2 equal to zero, this is Lagrangian, So what it means in this geometrical picture, what it means to be entangled is that each equation which defines it depends on both sets of variables. So let's draw a picture. So in, say, the Q1, Qt plane, L is like this. It's just a line. whereas separable states will be something like this. It'll be horizontal or vertical. So because it's at an interesting angle, which is neither horizontal nor vertical, that because the equation defining it involves both sets of variables, this is the geometric incarnation of entanglement. OK, so let's figure out what the quantum state corresponding to this is. Okay, well, this satisfies Q1 psi L is equal to Q2 psi L, and d by dQ1 plus d by dQ2 so the solution to this is psi L Q1 Q2 is simply the delta function at Q1 equals Q2. But we could have just read this off this picture. Like in the Q1 Q2 plane, it's supported along this line. That tells us it has to vanish away from there. It's going to be related to a delta. Okay, so why is this entangled? The delta function at Q1 equals C times the delta function at Q2 equals C, these are separable states. So it's this, you know, the tensor product of a state from each subsystem. The delta function at Q1 equals Q2 is integral. It's the integral of these separable states, so it's entangled. We need to draw another picture. So the separable states in the Q1, Q2 plane separable states live at points in the Q1, Q2 plane and are entangled states, the big sum of them over here. Well, that was obvious. Any questions about that?
Is there any way to make the product of the two manifolds M1, M2 non-commutative in a way? And would that have any physical interpretation?
I suppose you could change the symplectic form by adding on a term that involved Q1 and Q2 or something like that. The physical interpretation would be you no longer have a product system. You're deforming the kinematics. You're doing some kind of deformation of the kinematics of your product.
Can you explain again why it is an entangled state?
Oh, I've admitted my understanding of entanglement is a bit naive, but I just mean the delta function, when Q takes some value, when Q1 takes some value, that's a basis for one Hilbert space. The delta function when Q2 takes some value is a basis for the other Hilbert space. And this is just the sum, and a big infinite sum of products of basis elements. So it looks like what you write down when you write down it. I didn't do any measurement of entanglement entropy or anything like that. I don't even know if there's a classical version of that. That would be interesting. I mean, in like the 5 minutes that's left, I want to do one more example, which is very similar, but in a system with a finite dimensional Hilbert space. And I hope that you'll see that it should be a familiar example of entanglement. Let's take this system with the torus. Q omega is like 2dQ dp, and p is e to the 2 pi I p. So I'm going to take the torus to have area 2. The commutation relations in this case, normally there's a factor of e to the 2 pi I over n. But n is 2. Hilbert space has two states where it's up. So this is like a special case of the system we wrote down before. I don't have time to develop it, but it's worth remarking, and you guys can play with it if you want, that this algebra means P and Q anti-commute. So actually, this system is equivalent to a free fermion, two-dimensional Hilbert space. OK, so how do we write down I want to write down an entangled state. So we'll do the same as before. We'll take two such systems. basis E1, E2, U2, and the Lagrangian inside the product of two copies of the torus is the set where U1 equals Q2 and P1 is equal to minus P2. This is exactly what we had before, except I'm making everything periodic. Okay, so when I quantize, what's the state? Well, the state is going to have Q1 psi, psi, Q2 psi. And well, you think about the exponentials, the minus sign drops out. And we'll write a state as something like up tensor down. But these are the two systems. If we solve these equations, the state will be psi equals up, tensor up, plus down, tensor down. Okay, so I know I went through this pretty quickly. Hold on.
Isn't there a phase in front of the P1 psi equals P2 psi of sorts on this condition?
Oh, because we, if we exponentiate this guy?
The Q1, yes, but what about...
Oh, because it's because they're... it doesn't really matter. I mean, it turns out that P squared is 1, this representation. But okay, that may be clearer. If you were to work it out, that would be the solution. So we're kind of seeing that the fact that the equation we started with mixes the two sets of Qs leads us to finding a state which is really entangled in the ordinary sense. Next time we'll discuss states of classical field theory.
Can you talk a little more about states?
I have to say I don't understand them as well as I should, and how they appear in this story as well as I should. My intuition is, you know, a mixed state is some kind of probabilistic ensemble of pure states. and if I look, if I try to repeat this procedure for a mixed state, there's no guarantee I would get n equations. You might get a smaller number of equations. My guess would be that there's a generalization of the notion of Lagrangian, which is called coisotropic, which is a submanifold, and there's no, I mean, we don't constrain the dimension a priori. It's just, we just impose the constraint. Coisotropic. If when FG vanish on C, so does so the kind of thing you would get is locally you ask that some of the p's vanish, but not all. Yeah, and my guess is mixed states are related to these. Good vague.
And the reason why we can see in the other side in the operators that f and g acting on a state and giving you zero implies that the commutator does is because of associativity.
Yes.
Is there a way to do this without associativity, or?
I don't think so. I think I feel like associativity is really baked in to the formalism, and we discussed this briefly. It ultimately comes from quantum mechanics. The product is defined by prime order product, and then you can see associativity by thinking about three of those guys.
Can I ask about something you talked about earlier? You briefly mentioned that you forgot to mention that condition on L, which corresponds to state only if the BS, the Bohr-Shomer
function. Yeah.
Do you have like a geometric picture of that or some intuition about why this is a necessary condition?
No, I don't have a great geometric picture. I feel, you know, this should be necessary for the same reason we saw it before. We saw it before when we were studying quantizing the cylinder. We saw that if we didn't include this condition, we had too many states in our Hilbert space. So I don't really have a great argument otherwise. There might be some discussion in this paper of Witten.
The capital P and the capital Q, they behave as fermions, but this is not a supermanifold. It's not a
classical fermion. That's right. So it's a little odd that. The notion of associative algebra is the same whether I have bosons or fermions. It's only when I try to take the classical limit do I decide I want to look at commutators or anticommutators. So I feel like there's nothing stopping you finding a system of fermions by doing some radical quantization to an ordinary manifold.
Yeah, even in fact, in this case, the fact that the anticommute is the same as the claim, I think, or similar to the fact that sigma z and sigma x, the anticommute, the polymatrices, I mean, sigma z and sigma x. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Here they swap the p is sigma x because it swaps up and down. Q is sigma
yes.
z. It's playing the role.
But you only have two of them here. You only have two of them because. Torus only has not two natural coordinates. Three.
During the tutorial, we had a question where we had a free fermion, and in the end, our base space only actually has one coordinate. How is this? Because this seems very different.
It does. I mean, you should think, because I've set the area to be 2, the classical system is a good approximation with very, very large area. So this system doesn't actually, in some sense, know all that much about the classical system. I recover it by sending the area to infinity. Kind of very strongly quantized. So maybe that's why it's not so weird.
I guess what I meant is how does this system recover that, because the base space in the other example is like one dimensional, here is two dimensional,
I think you would. We have this system, and then there's two separate ways of taking a classical limit. One is you put on this manifold and take the manifold of be larger and larger, and we get more and more operators, and we recover the phase space. The other is insert some, take this, these operators as written and insert some factors of h-bar so that in the classical limit, the commutator becomes an is related to the anti-commutator. We get an anti-Poisson bracket. And that way we'd recover the supermanifold picture.
I don't know if this is the same question as you're asking or not, but it feels like this is kind of different from the example in the tutorial because or one way in which it is different is that Q and P are not Grassmann variables here, but it feels like they should, unless they...
But that's something you only... To say Q and P are Grassmann variables, that's really a classical statement. Because for the quantum system, you just have operators and they don't commute, and it's the same thing whether it's bosons or fermions. The distinction between bosons and fermions really happens in quantum field theory when I kind of grade them past.
Can you explain what you mean when you say Grassmann variables are classical objects? Because we usually treat fermions similarly, right? And we treat them in quantum field theory where we quantize.
Right. And so in quantum field theory, you can tell because I look at two different points and I say, well, the operators at two different points anti-commute. But in quantum mechanics, I only have one space point. So you can't, no operators, operators just won't commute with each other in any way. So the axioms of quantum mechanics just say you have an algebra. It could look, that algebra could have some classical limit, which looks like some Grassmann variables, or the same algebra could have some other classical limit, which looks like ordinary commuting variables.
Can you give us some examples of Lagrangian that does not generate the maximally entangled state plus two of the state is entangled?
It doesn't generate a maximally entangled state, but it's still entangled? Probably you would have to work with a bigger system, wouldn't you? And yeah, so suppose each of these systems was larger and had some two extra sets of variables. And then I could say, I could take a Lagrangian. Yeah, I could take this guy and then I can just kind of product on some things which were just separable Lagrangian. So maybe this one had two Qs, the other one had two Qs. And my equation, I need to give four equations and two of those equations would mix the variables, and two of them wouldn't.
I would have had the intuition from his question that changing the steepness of the line would also, just like before,
That should just change the coefficients that appear. Is that the kind of thing you want?
Half PQ2, like that changes some steepness of some line in the torus.
Yeah.
And then that, you can interpolate between that and that coefficient up front, for instance, could sit, well, yeah, Q1 is equal to zero, you probably are in a pure state with Q.
Yeah.
And with when Q2 is equal to zero, you would be in the other pure state. And so that coefficient, the fact that it's equal to one is the thing I think that all could also be related to.
Yeah. Entanglement. I think you're right. I think to engineer that, though, you need to have, the Lagrangian is really tightly constrained by this fact that it has to be a Bohr-Sommerfeld orbit. So in this particular case, with area two, I think that's all you have. But if I had a torus with bigger area, more states, there'd be more freedom.